Welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing you a program dedicated to the life of the mind. In this program, we visit Joy Bear. She's a solid-state chemist, or perhaps more easily understood as a mineral chemist. Joy has had a career I can only have the greatest admiration for. On her CV, there's a short list of qualifications that shows a massive leap from a couple of diplomas in the early 1950s to a senior doctoral degree in applied science. All the usual rungs in the under and postgraduate degree ladder are missing. She did this through her sheer ability at the lab bench and making significant scientific discoveries in her field. I went to talk to her on her home territory in a CSIRO establishment here in Melbourne, among all the chem labs, which I'm afraid shows up in the recordings at times. Joy ran her own research team and project at CSIRO for many years. We began by discussing how she came to be a scientist.
As a child, born in country Victoria, I knew nothing about science. I loved riding an old horse we had, so I thought I'd be a jackaroo. Yeah.
What part of the country was it?
Derrinallen, down the Western District. Mm-hmm. Then when the family moved to the city when I was nine, being a jackaroo seemed to be out of reach, so I decided I'd be a motor mechanic. My first year at Hampton High School was a defining year in my career. We had a science and maths teacher who was a strict disciplinarian and didn't in general excite me about science.
His name, I think, was it Swaby?
That's right. He was an amateur astronomer, and occasionally, maybe it was once a term, he forgot about the curriculum and talked about stars and planets. Mm. And I was enthralled. I decided I wanted to be an astronomer. However, from second year at high school, the classes were divided into two sections, professional and commercial. As my parents knew nothing about science, they decided I should do the commercial course, including shorthand and typing, so I could always get a job. However, in my last year at high school, the leaving matriculation year, I persuaded them to let me change over to the professional course. I had a lot of catching up to do, of course, and could only fit in chemistry and physics, no maths. I persuaded them to let me change over to the professional course. And at the end of the year, my father visited the observatory, which was in the Melbourne domain then, only to find there was no work there. We learned later that the telescope had recently been moved to Canberra. And the person my father spoke to, said that if I wanted to do research, I would need a degree. That was out of the question. My parents could not afford the upfront fees necessary to obtain a university degree. So
you had to go to work then.
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about getting that job, because it seemed to be a bit of a turning point, I think, wasn't it?
Yes. It was in February 1944 I obtained a position as junior laboratory assistant in the mineral utilisation section of the Division of Industrial Chemistry at the then CSIR, and took myself off to Knight School at Melbourne Technical College. And I was told that if I obtained a diploma by part-time study, I would automatically be promoted to the research staff. So, thinking that I would make doubly sure of that promotion, I undertook two diplomas concomitantly, applied science and applied chemistry. And I attended night school for 6 years, averaging four nights a week for five of those years, and both diplomas were conferred in March 1950. In those days, men were the breadwinners, and women were expected to get married and stay home and look after the children, so a lot of people reckon women didn't need education.
But would it be fair to say that you had a passion for science by this stage of your life?
Yes, it was important to me. I felt it was important to do it, but it took a lot of effort. Obtaining an education in this way, it had two effects, because working constantly as a lab assistant, gave me good experience in applied aspects of research, but night school didn't allow me time to read broadly, so I feel my theoretical background was really much weaker than if I'd done a full-time university degree, which worried me a bit. I had to really want to do the night course. There's a poem, I think, that says, "Two kinds of courage are there in the lives of simple men, I think it's something like this. One is courage not born, fibred and half, not born upon it. The other courage is of doubtful breed, for even cowardice on chance forlorn may snatch, forgotten how it goes, with one bright dazzling deed." But then it goes on and says, "What is this that holds me in perpetual ease? How can I give such motley thing a name that wins no battles, yet will not sue for peace, that dares to cry, 'Alas, my strength is gone,' that droops, revives, that falters and fights on? Is this thing courage or but fear of shame?" And I often thought of that, you know, halfway through the course, it seemed so long to go on, and yet you've done so much, why give it up? But anyway, so I found that once I started doing that kind of science that I enjoyed that very much.
But then you managed to get away for a stint working in the United Kingdom.
Put it that way, getting away.
Why did you go then?
Unfortunately, during the 6 years that it had taken me to obtain my diplomas, the University of Melbourne had introduced a PhD degree. So a BSc, or a couple of diplomas, was no longer adequate for promotion to the research staff at CSIR. And I was only promoted to technical officer, or later it was renamed experimental scientist. So I decided to get some overseas experience in the UK. I worked for a year or more in the metallurgy division of the Atomic Energy Establishment at Harwell in Berkshire. And I undertook some very interesting research on the interdiffusion of uranium metal, firstly with copper and then aluminium metal. Then I spent about 18 months in the metallurgy department of the University of Birmingham, working under Professor Cottrell and Robert Kahn. Professor Cottrell later became the UK government scientist, you know. But I returned home in 1953, and I rejoined the minerals utilisation section of CSIR, and I still only held an experimental scientist position, which didn't please me.
Well, do you think you actually benefited much from that experience in the UK?
Yes.
Do you learning?
Oh, yes. In fact, if solid-state diffusion has cropped up time and again in the projects that I have done since then. At that time, Australia wasn't leading the world in research as much as it does now, and working with scientists like Cottrell and Kahn and others that were right on the forefront of research was really very exciting.
It sounds like it would have given you a bit of self-confidence, which is something I meant to ask you about your high school years, actually. You were a head prefect.
Yes.
So I think you must have had a lot of self-confidence as a young woman.
Yes, I suppose I did. It depends what situation, I suppose. Socially, I didn't mix well, probably because I didn't have the opportunity while I was going to night school to go out and socialise. And I can remember one Monday mornings we used to stand up and take the oath, "I love God and so on," and something happened and the teachers didn't come out, or the principal didn't come out to take the assembly. We were all assembled out in front of the school. So eventually, when nothing happened, I got up and made everyone take the oath and whatnot. And when we went in, the teachers had arrived, they were grinning all over their faces, having the cheek to get up there and take the assembly.
There was a change in the institutional nature of CSIR became CSIRO.
Yes, until recently, when I feel CSIRO, as it now is, it's become too commercialised and not enough fundamental research is undertaken. I have always held both CSIR and CSIRO in high esteem, and I've been a proud to be a member of both. In fact, I wouldn't be here now if I hadn't been. But political upheaval in 1948 that caused the name change and restructuring of the organisation arose when it was alleged that important information from the USA was being denied to Australia because CSIR was employing disloyal scientists with communist sympathies. The fuss did not involve any of my work in the minerals utilisation section, and most of the work in this section proceeded as usual. However, this did disadvantage at least one scientist who was working on a uranium project. Visiting overseas institutions at that time, he had some institutions would not discuss their researches with him, which was a bit irritating. But with time, everyone seemed to get over the problem. And with the restructuring, the divisions that were involved with work that affected defence were transferred to the Department of Supply, and we were left without anything that they could worry about.
You work for somebody, not with them.
As a technical assistant or officer, the research scientist would set the program as a rule, and the technical scientist would have to follow that program. I worked with Ken McTaggart, who was a research scientist, and I worked on phototropic effects after he'd worked with a pigment firm in the UK for a period, and titanium dioxide is commonly used as pigments in paints, and it is well known in the industry that certain impurities in the white pigment causes the pigment to change colour when exposed to light, and the colour is reversed in the dark. This kind of change is known as phototropic effects, and the pigment companies used to, I think, add phosphate and phosphorus that stop that colour change occurring. But McTaggart had having worked with this pigment company, was interested in what caused the colour change. It's known as a phototropic effect, and he and I, as the technical scientist, investigated the cause of these colour changes both in titanium dioxide and other oxides. In the case of titanium dioxide, the titanium dioxide gives off oxygen when exposed to light or radiation, which oxidises the impurity to a coloured compound depending on what the impurity is. In the dark, the titanium dioxide takes back its oxygen and thus reverses the process. Get back to your white
colour. It's white in the dark and not white.
Yes, it was quite an interesting study. The electrochemistry projects came along later in my career. These projects mainly concerned the production of anodes for the electrowinning of metals. My experimental scientist, Dennis Barclay, and I prepared the anodes while Race Cues undertook the actual electrowinning process, and that process was patented by Skews and myself. And another major project that continued over many years, and indeed up to the time of my official retirement, was undertaken in partnership with Bob Flan. It concerned the production of anodes from Western Mining Corporation's nickel powder for, they wanted to prepare anodes from their powder for plating purposes. We were assisted by other members of staff and short-term appointees at that time were on government-sponsored sponsorship funds. And we successfully developed an activated sintering process for we'd compact the powder and then sinter the compacts to produce pure nickel basket anodes. The plating house, we tested these in a commercial plating bath, and having observed the nickel anodes that we prepared working well, they asked us if we could produce nickel iron alloy anodes because they used to plate Nikolai alloy as an undercoat to Nikon, because that's cheaper than straight Nikon. We thought that wouldn't be any trouble. But when we prepared compacts from a mixture of iron powder with a sulfatized nickel powder that we were using to prepare the straight anodes, straight nickel anodes, we found that when we sintered these compacts, the compacts prepared from the mixed iron nickel powders, the compacts swelled excessively on sintering. These are not suitable for anodes because they break up and leave a lot of residue. A colleague working with McKeon McDonald solved the problem by not mixing the powders. He added the powders to the dye before compaction in two layers, so that the compact, in fact, were two separate layers. They were connected, centered, and one layer was nickel, sulfidized nickel, and the other iron. These sintered compacts didn't swell and produce suitable anodes, but the cause of swelling was what was interesting me, and that work continued. The cause of the swelling.
Are people still researching that area now?
Yes. It was dropped when I retired and I was compiling the book. It was left, but I'll come back to it later. It's a very intriguing problem.
Ian Holtham playing Lux Aeterna from Christo McCann's Songs of Truth and Loneliness. We're in the study and we're talking to Joy Bear, mineral chemist.
Another interesting one, which is this research into what was, I think, originally referred to as argillate odor.
Yes.
But more generally the smell of rain, because it's not necessarily restricted to clays.
It's well known that clays, that is argillaceous materials in particular, give off a very characteristic odour when moistened by the first rain after a long dry spell, and that's important. You must have the long dry spell before the rain comes. Now, Mr. Thomas, R.G. Thomas, the head of the minerals utilisation section, had long been intrigued by this odour and often spoke about it. Until one day the chief of division, Dr. Walk, said, for goodness sake, you better get someone to do something about it. Thomas was a very unusual man. As section head, Thomas didn't have time to would stop to undertake the work for himself. So, to my delight, the project was eventually given to me. As you mentioned, this project was of considerable public interest, but it was not approved by some scientists in CSIRO. They thought that there were more important projects to be researched and that we should be spending our money on. And here, hence my good luck, the project had ended up with me. And apart from using Thomas's knowledge and past experience, I was able to run the project the way I wanted to, even though as an experimental scientist. Thomas was aware that this special odour was not only generated by clay materials, but by rocks and minerals in general. So he gave the odour the name petrichor, derived from the prefix petri, meaning rock or stone, and ichor, meaning tenuous essence, thus the tenuous essence derived from rock or stone.
Essence of stone.
Mm-hmm. And by exposing various materials that were initially odour-free to the atmosphere under dry conditions for extended periods, then using steam distillation, we were able to extract an oil from the source material that had the characteristic petrichor odour. And from extensive analysis of this oil, we concluded that petrichor results from a contamination of a combination, really, from a combination of a number of natural processes. These processes involve the admittance to the atmosphere of volatile or organic compounds from the animal and vegetal matter, the degradation and partial oxidation and nitration of these compounds in the atmosphere, the selective absorption, fixation and transformation of specific compounds by the clay or the silicate-containing rock material, and then finally the return to the atmosphere of the volatile and odorous products of this process by displacement by water when the rains came. The project was of such public interest that it was discussed by Magnus Pike on the BBC and later published as a chapter in his book Butter Cider. Sessions were recorded and published in papers over here too. Well, at the time that we were doing this research, there was a small industry in India where they exposed baked clay discs to the open sun during the hot summer months of May and June. Then they collected the discs before the wet season set in, steam distilled them. The vapor given off, which was petrichor, containing that odour, the vapors were absorbed in sandalwood oil, and the perfume so obtained is known as Mati Ka Atta, I think that's the pronunciation, or in our language, earth perfume.
There was some speculation on whether this process had anything to do with the genesis of petroleum. Did anything come of that idea in the end?
Not really. The idea still stands. It was Thomas's idea, and I haven't read again lately what his ideas were, but in general, he thought that not all the compounds were volatile, and those that remained in the clay, soil, rock, would be washed into streams and lakes, rivers, over the years, and then find their way into the soil, and over the years would accumulate to form. And there is some suggestion from our work that the compounds change to the petroleum, the hydrocarbon types, but it would be probably hard to prove unless you'd probably have to have it from many years sitting on some rocks or something.
If you've got geological timescales.
Thomas was aware that the odour was petrichor, was given off by materials other than clay, and we confirmed this by collecting and exposing various dried rocks and mineral substances that were collected elsewhere, exposing them to the atmosphere. And one of these materials was volcanic scoria from Mount Elephant in Victoria, a sudden memory from my childhood. The scoria we visited.
Not far from Durham.
That's right. And we visited the family, and my eldest sister was allowed to climb Mount Elephant, but I wasn't. So when we went back to collect scoria, I climbed Mount Elephant. we also collected kaolin from Bullen, Victoria. Thomas also had some uranium ores. He was a great geologist. Notably, the uranium ore, when exposed to the dry atmosphere, also generated the odour, demonstrating that the odour is not generated by microbacteria or the like, which is often suggested. Yet clays and soils that are exposed for any time to damp often give off an odour, but it's not the same odour as petrichor.
It seems to me really the central research of your career, which is the discovery of some zirconium compounds. My impression is this is what really made your career. The petrichor might have been fun, but the zirconium compounds are really the important part.
Yes, you're quite right.
Can you tell us something about what was driving the research and how you came to make these discoveries?
One of our outstanding scientists, Ivan Newnham, was visiting France, and he discovered that a French company was tanning Australian sheepskins with zirconium sulfate made from Australian mineral zircon. And he thought, why on earth can't we make zirconium sulfate from our own zircon and tan our own hides? seemed reasonable. So when he returned home, he set about with his team developing a process for producing zirconium salts from zircon. And before the process had been completed, Newnham became chief of the division, so he was no longer able to be directly involved in the process himself. He asked a research scientist that I was working with to investigate the dehydration of zirconium sulfate tetrahydrate. The tetrahydrate containing four water molecules was well known to be the stable phase at room temperature. The highest hydrate known, the tetrahydrate, that is, was the highest hydrate known at that time. Some scientists thought that during dehydration to the anhydrous phase, that is zirconium sulfate without any water molecules, a monohydrate was formed, but this had not been established. Anhydrous zirconium sulfate was deliquescent, that is, rapidly picking up moisture when exposed to the atmosphere, and then it would rehydrate to the stable tetrahydrate. So the research scientist I was working with asked me to initially prepare a stock of pure zirconium tetrahydrate by heating the laboratory stock of tetrahydrate with sulfuric acid to form the pure anhydrous sulfate, then exposing this product on a dish or a watch glass to the atmosphere and allowing it to rehydrate to the tetrahydrate. So fortuitously, demonstrating my interest in science, while watching this rehydration, I noticed that the initial needle-like crystals formed, which then converted to the standard tetrahydrate type crystals. At first, of course, I thought the needles were possibly monohydrate crystals, but I devised a means of stabilizing the crystals and analyzing them, and I found the needle crystals were of a previously unknown zirconium sulfate compound, a pentahydrate, that is, they're containing five molecules of water. And this was the beginning of an extensive study which isolated a pentahydrate with two different crystal structures. They're polymorphs, a heptahydrate, seven water molecules, and several monohydrates. All these compounds reconverted to the stable tetrahydrate if exposed to the atmosphere at room temperature. That is, they are metastable relative to the tetrahydrate under normal atmospheric conditions. An expert crystallographer, Gus Mummy, he'd been trained by our outstanding international standard scientist Dave Wadsley. Wadsley was a superb crystallographer. And so Gus joined me early in the study to determine the crystal structures of the compounds.
You had developed or learnt very good lab skills.
Yes.
But as you say, earlier on, because you weren't able to get a degree, you didn't have the theoretical strength. But I think at this point it seems to me that you are developing a good theoretical knowledge as well, and bringing those two bringing the two things together very effectively.
And it was a bit devious. When I found this first pentahydrate, I didn't tell my research scientist that I'd found it until we have to report to the chief, once in 3 months or something. And it's technically scientists are supposed to give their report to their research scientist, but I didn't give my report to him until we both put in our reports to the chief, so that the chief knew that I made the discovery. Otherwise, it's always assumed that it's the research scientist. You're carrying out his project. It was always his at that stage, and that it would be his finding. Yeah. So it was a bit devious there, but it paid off.
Sounds like a good idea, yeah. did any of this have any connection with ceramics, for example, or other things that
did? Yeah. In later years, not at this time, to deviate a bit, although a good process was developed at this time by Newnham's team for producing zirconium salts. We couldn't get anyone commercially to take the process up. And it was years later that when the other division found partially stabilized zirconia that was going to be used for all kinds of construction materials and whatnot, that we again got involved in developing a different type of process for developing zirconium salts. We did that in conjunction with, I think it was ICI, and eventually the process was commercialised.
I asked Joy to explain metastability.
It's difficult to answer precisely in a few words, and so my explanation will just be in a broad overview of what we established, not just for our compounds, but we believe applies to all metastable phases in general. So firstly, the relative stabilities of various phases are revealed by their chemical potential, the most stable phase being the one with the lowest value of potential energy. Secondly, in a system containing a series of phases, the stable phase of each composition can only form over a specific region of temperature and partial pressure of its volatile components. This temperature pressure region is known as the phase field or stability or existence region of the compound. The phase field of a metastable phase always lies within the phase field of a more stable phase. Then thirdly, when the product of a solid vapor reaction is of a specific composition but exists in more than one structural form, that is, it's polymorphic, then the polymorph that is formed is likely to be one whose structure is closest crystallographically to the structure of the parent compound, as this polymorph is likely to be separated from the reactant by the lowest energy barrier. But we established all these points in our study of the metastability of the compound.
Gabriella Smart playing An Offering of Intimacy by Ju Giana. You're in the study with Craig Robertson and I'm talking to Joy Bear, mineral chemist.
Do you think you've covered a pretty good range of research?
Yes.
A nice fields over the years?
Yes, I think I've been very fortunate.
Well, it sort of leads on to my next point, which is, of course, is that you've been a groundbreaker for women in all this, considering that you had a handicap regarding formal qualifications.
Yes.
Your CV sort of leaps from diplomas through to a senior doctoral degree.
Yes.
Conferred by the Victoria Institute of Colleges.
Yes.
You've won that really through your work, which is really a testament to your abilities. Is it still possible for people to do this, or does it happen very often? I mean,
well,
it seems fairly exceptional.
Yes, and it's not so necessary these days because pending scientists go to university and to have their PhD. PhD is the basic qualification for becoming research staff, but I dare say if someone with a lower qualification really discovered something worthwhile, they could find their way up. I was fortunate in that when I discovered these compounds, Newnham was the chief, and he'd known the quality of my work for many years, and this was the thing that he could make out an argument for, but he had the moral courage to make out that argument for a woman, because in those days, as I mentioned, women were supposed to stay home and look after the family. They didn't need to have education. In CSIR and other companies, and if a woman were employed by CSIR, married, she had to resign. Mm. She was out. Didn't matter how good her science was. And so it did take moral courage to make out an important case like this for a woman, because the executive reckoned she didn't do anything for a woman unless you were having a piece of her. And Newnham told me that, and when he was arguing with them for my promotion, that one said, I was top of experimental scientists grade 3 range, and I would be transferred to the bottom rung of senior research scientist, and then the next range up was principal research scientist. And one member of the executive said to him, oh, you want to make her a principal research scientist next? and he wouldn't get away with it these days, of course, with the anti-discrimination laws, but he could then. And Newnham told me, he just said, well, that's up to her. And so it was with great satisfaction when 11 years on I was able to write to him. He moved up to director of several divisions and was located at the regional office in Queen Street. So it was great satisfaction that I could write to him and say that I'd been awarded a senior doctoral degree for my published research.
Your major promotion was about 1967, I think.
Yes, I think that's right.
You were basically, as I interpreted, given your own research
team
program.
Yes, the way I went.
Yeah, it must have been a very exciting time.
Lovely. Promotion came before we'd done all the crystallography on the compounds, and just Mummy and I were working together, so that it wasn't as it had been previously, even though I hadn't actually been promoted at that stage, but got going on my own.
I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about how you got involved with science education. And, well in fact, you gave this Dennis Driscoll lecture in 1989 to some teachers.
My theme was to try and inspire both teachers and students, and to provide them with information about some of the extramural activities they can become involved in to learn from and to enjoy. I don't know whether I succeeded, but I tried. I got my DSC degree, and then in 1986 I was awarded and became a member of the Order of Australia. No, I'll go back. When I got the DSC degree, it was from the Victoria Institute of Colleges. It was at the stage where the technical colleges had been lifted to university standard, but there was the overall organisation seeing that the universities and all the technical colleges maintained that standard. And this DSC degree, or D-applied SSC degree, I had conferred by RMIT University. And it was the first DSC degree that had been given since the formation of the Technical University. So this appeared in news and the papers and pictures and whatnot. And I think the organisation, the committees that mm-hmm. maintain the standards and look after all the universities, that's all this in the paper, and they thought, apparently she'd be a good person to have on the committee, and that's how I got the invitation to go, and one invitation leads to others.
Can you tell us a little bit about Wadsley? he was nominated for a Nobel Prize, is that right?
Yes.
You say in one of the lectures, I think, that he had developed a centre of excellence, that's the sort of thing it's really difficult to do now.
That section was scrubbed later on. He didn't start as a crystallographer. He graduated from University of Tasmania, and he came to work eventually in the minerals utilisation section, and I think it would be during Moyer years that he was working on making manganese batteries or something like that. And I don't know I've forgotten where his interest in crystallography came from, but he started to study that, and it grew, and he became an international expert. He collaborated with some outstanding Swedish scientists. One important thing was the structure of non-stoichiometric compounds, and at the time everyone thought non-stoichiometry, that is not a uniform composition, was caused by either having vacancies in the structure or atoms inserted between other atoms. But he demonstrated with his Swedish scientists that it's not individual atoms like that, whole blocks of the compound shear, and that gives the change in composition. I can't relate all the details of it. So not only then did he became international standing, but he also developed new X-ray techniques and whatnot. So he was so famous that the Nobel Committee wrote to Newnham, who was the chief, asking him to be nominated. But tragically, when Newnham was in the middle of making out the nomination, and once he had a heart attack while at a conference, and you can't get the Nobel Prize once you're dead.
Let's move on to your retirement, or I should say your so-called retirement. You've maintained a high rate of activity, obviously.
Yes, and have unfortunately.
Produced a very handsome volume. History of your division.
Yes.
Well, I was interested to ask you about how you view this history and its importance.
I think it's the most important thing I've ever done, compiling it. They had me as an author, as the others, but I was the main compiler. I got the scientists and all the other people, not just scientists, to write me out something, and I was putting it all together. And
why do you say it's the most important?
Most important because it not only records the outstanding scientific contributions made by many members of the division, which can provide useful information for future scientists, but it also provides a record of the rapid change in technology that's occurred over the years. I find an interesting thing, because now I can't keep up with the rate of change in the computers and everything that's going on.
Well, I'm interested in the idea of institutional memory too, because I think a book like that also shows us something of what the institution was like
back in those days,
a generation ago.
Yes. That's quite so.
It gives some hope of comparing the present with the past.
Yes, I hope so. But I still think money will count more.
The Royal Australian Chemical Institute. Can you tell us a bit about your involvement there?
Yes, I suppose the Royal Australian Chemical Institute concerns chemistry, of course. It has a committee to assess people. The organisation's not just one that you can pay a fee and join up with. You have to pass several qualifications to be admitted at various levels. It is a qualification in itself, and indeed I've used it in the past with some of my team to get them a promotion if they could join the RACI. And they have a committee assessing the various applications, and I've been on that committee for a long time now, and they also have a history and archives committee. Just at the moment they're thinking about writing a history of the RACI.
Well, of course, what we must mention here is that they awarded you the Leighton Medal, which is their highest award, and you were the first woman to get it.
Yeah. Again, women didn't count much, but I should mention that the RACTI, some of the women, set up a group called the Women in Chemistry to fight battles for women. And I was a foundation member of that, and for a period I was president. It was the women in chemistry that talked to the RACI committee, deciding on who to give the Leighton lecture, and were able to persuade them that I was the best person. So I became the first woman to ever give that lecture.
Do you think scientists in general get enough recognition?
Well, it depends who from. There are a lot more prizes and certificates and awards given within the science community these days. In fact, if you look down in our the displays down in the reception area, all kinds of awards are given. But I don't know that the common population know much more about scientists than they used to know. It's a bit hard to tell, but some people have never heard of CSIRO. The general population are using what comes out of science all the time. Microphones, computers, medical equipment and whatnot, but they don't appreciate that it takes scientists to produce these things. Doing the science, of course, as always, you will have gathered, absorbed me, and getting recognition is great. If I'd stayed an experimental scientist all my career, I would have given the science all my attention, but it wouldn't have been as satisfying as it has after my promotion. So that's been very fulfilling. I've found putting the history together very fulfilling too, because I feel that that knowledge is worth having. But I've had a very satisfying, happy career. I think I'm lucky that I made my career over the years that I did. Minerals were very important. CSIRO was less commercialised. I wouldn't enjoy it so much if I were really making my career now and have to go out to industry and say, oh, give me some money to do this research.
Even though you did work quite successfully with industry.
Yes, with industry. Mm.
Yeah. Anyway, well, what are you working on now?
I mentioned the swelling of those nickel compacts. It was put aside for about 15 years, I suppose, when I did the book and other things. But I've taken it up again, and it's really interesting.
You get to work at your lab bench again.
Yes, but not so much, because it's safety regulations these days. You can't do this, you can't do that. And I haven't got my own lab where I know all my equipment is. So it's a little bit difficult to carry on again. But I think I've got enough results from the past that I might be able to work something out. Mm. Keep my fingers crossed.
Good.
And it keeps me involved.
Great. These podcasts are pretty much about looking at the past, at least as it lives in memory. Although we try and focus on ideas that may be every bit as relevant now as they were then. In my study, the past is a huge subject nowadays, in spite of a reluctance in my youth to look back. Now, family history suddenly becomes interesting, for example.
I've always taken that as an article of faith, that we need to know the past in order to have a better future. There is the old adage that to forget history was to be condemned to repeat it. But the place of the past in shaping the future seems to me a struggle between attitudes around two poles, and it's fascinating to follow the shifts between these poles at different times. For want of better descriptions, I'll call them, on the one hand, the past are forget it pole, and on the other hand, the you must remember this pole. Let's look at the are forget it pole first. There are diverse approaches to this attitude. Henry Ford said history is bunk. In other words, the practical mind finds the past useless. But, on the other hand, Henry David Thoreau, a very different mindset, also thought one was blessed not to lose a moment remembering the past, forgetfulness being the natural state and thus the preferred state. In Australia, we've had the young tree green idea. Australians who had been in Europe in the 1930s, such as Manning Clark and Patrick White, returned to Australia after World War II wanting to forget about Europe and its culture of death. They wanted to make a fresh start. This was an attempt to see Australia as a clean slate, a cultural and literary equivalent of terra nullius, perhaps. Ironically, this was just as others, such as George Johnson and Charmian Cliff, were leaving Australia because of a quite opposite feeling about Australian culture. Fresh starts have always had their attractions. In 1996, my wife Wei and I visited some Buddhist temples in China. It was a situation where the guidebook indicated that the Red Guards had trashed the temple and the Cultural Revolution. But when you got there, information on the site said that the British had trashed it in 1861 and the French in 1905 or some such. One temple had been rebuilt 17 times over the centuries. Red Guardism itself has a long history. The pioneering Red Guards, I suppose, were the English Puritans, who trashed the churches and destroyed a lot of art. This was to prove consistent with a long tradition of Christian obliteration of the cultures of colonised peoples, of the heathens. The destruction of the Summer Palace in Beijing being a mind-boggling example of this. This is 1861 again. Then, of course, there was Year Zero in Paris in 1793 and the dreadful attempt to do it again in Cambodia in 1975. We don't want to go there. Such streams of the past are forget us, show that not knowing history can really mean repeating its mistakes in the worst possible way. So let's look at the you must remember this poll. There are many aspects to this too, but we can remember that reference to the past was fundamental to two of the most powerful influences on the 20th century, Marx and Freud. Both wanted to use the past to generate a future at the social and at the individual levels respectively. As the traumas of that 20th century start to slowly fade in the memories of the living, we can ask whether anything worthwhile was gained from either of those philosophies. I guess I can't answer that big a question here, but let's remember, particularly in reference to Marx, that there are numerous myths of the Golden Age and its restoration. Marx was part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, giving society a secularized version of the biblical fall, the struggle of history, of redemption and restoration. That narrative was a powerful cultural driver for 2,000 years. It gave meaning to life and to the most appalling suffering. Hopefully we have learned to take care in our commitments to this sort of a dream by now, or we might find ourselves back to the Red Guards, or perhaps, say, the Hitler Youth singing "The Future Belongs to Me." The story that derives from the Judeo-Christian tradition resonates with the whole story of life as a journey, going out, of finding adventures, and then of coming home. Such a story resonates too with memory. But in fact, none of this is really memory. It is not reality, as science or hard-headed historical research would tell us. There was never a golden age, and therefore we can't return to it. However, this does teach us something about the role of story, which is very much about memory too. Story is essential for mnemonic purposes in pre-literate cultures, the you must remembers, teaching the tribe its history, how to live, and so on. I have wanted to explore how to live in the Australian environment. Simon Sharma, in his book Landscape and Memory, tells us that landscape is culture before it is nature. He illustrates this entertainingly for 500 plus pages, but the idea doesn't seem to go anywhere. I think Indigenous Australia has taken the idea much further, embracing and filling the landscape with story in a way that I wish today we could be stronger and more creative about in Australia, and more aware of the Indigenous past too, for that matter. There was never a literary terra nullius either. My work has been driven by this sort of thinking. It started with the Buckley story. I came to it via concern for the environment, wanting to recall how things were compared to what they are now, to embrace the landscape with story in a way that would help to give it respect. The past taught me something. Young Buckley, for me, was a man who told himself, "Don't look back." I thought, how else could he cope with his fate? But I can't seem to help looking back myself now. We all have sites of memory, of heritage, that we'd like to keep. Two of mine, a section of Gardiner's Creek here in Melbourne, where I first lived as a child with the story of Buckley, and an aunt's farm. These are both environments and pasts literally buried now by freeways. Knowing the past tells us that many of the animals, which is to say the characters in Indigenous stories, have been obliterated from the landscape. That should tell us something about shaping policies. At least there's a sort of cultural redguardism at work there too. My take on it after all this rambling, well, I still believe we have to know and understand the past for the sake of the future, but there's no formula. I'm still sympathetic to the young tree green idea, but the slate isn't a blank. It's got patterns around it with rainbow snakes and platypuses and bush stone curlews calling in the night, and many other things haunting the landscape that won't go away yet. Here's just one of them that Melburnians should know but probably won't. Alumina to Zirconium, The History of the CSIRO Division of Mineral Chemistry by Baer, Beagle and Scott is a CSIRO publication, 2001. Music in this program featured the following. Ian Holtham playing Lux Aeterna from The Songs of Truth and Loneliness by Christine McComb. That's on his album Giants in the Land. And Gabriella Smart on her album Chinese Whispers, playing An Offering of Intimacy by Drew Gianna. And our two regular themes are Ronald Farren Price playing the Bach Prelude in C from his album Reflections, and Elizabeth Anderson playing the Handel Suite No. 5 on her album The Convict Harpsichordist. Those albums are all from Move Records, and full details of each one is on the study website at www.thestudy.net.au. And so, until next time, it's shut the door and reading lamp only in the study.